All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for coming. As we always say to those who were in the Borghino Baseball Clubhouse for the first time, welcome. To those who have been here before, welcome home. We are live at the Borghino Baseball Clubhouse in the landmark cast iron building at 67 East 11th Street. Tonight, it is our pleasure to welcome Matthew Silverman, the author of a great new book called New York Mets, 50 Amazing Seasons, The Complete Illustrated History. I think that's the first time we've gotten an ovation for an author or anything Met-related, certainly.
Well, thank you.
And basically, I'm going to turn the floor over to you fairly quickly. Just in a little brief summary is when Matthew sent me the book, we had already had the event planned. And then I'll get the author will usually send the book after that. And I was shocked at the book. In all positive ways. I don't know what I was expecting, but probably it was my inner Mets fan coming out, expecting the book to not live up to what it should be, but your book is outstanding. And it's really, for those of you here, you can see it. For those listening to the podcast, you'll have to try to get this book wherever you can. New York Mets 50 Amazing Seasons by Matthew Silverman from MVP Books. But on the cover is a little apple that you pick up, just like the home run apple, and it changes from four old Mets to four more current Mets. And the only thing I would like to mention before we get going with Matthew is something he wrote at the end of the acknowledgments, which I thought was fantastic. Well, actually, his first sentence and his last sentence in the acknowledgments I loved. He opens with, in the acknowledgments, "Thanks to William A. Shea for doing the dirty work to bring the National League back to New York." I thought that was terrific. And he closes the acknowledgments by thanking a couple people, but he basically says these people helped him to corral the half century of nonstop drama, unforeseen miracles, and frequent heartache that is New York Mets baseball. And that is exactly right. And so to start, let's talk a little bit about you as a Mets fan. How old were you? How did it start? And, you know, take us through that.
Well, I did not grow up in a baseball household. I found out years later that my great-grandmother, who actually lived to be 100, used to go see the Yankees and Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig when, if you wanted to follow the team, you had to actually go. And she used to go there a lot, so. And ironically, the year she died, when she turned 100, was the year I became a Mets fan. And it just was very haphazard. They asked us in class. I went to Iona Grammar School in New Rochelle and actually was just there for an event a few weeks ago. And they said, you know, I was very into Army and plays and all kinds of other stuff that would probably have created a much more dynamic career if I had been as involved with them as I became in baseball. But so they have, it's opening day 1975. Both the Mets and the Yankees are playing at Shea Stadium. They're not playing that day. The Yankees are maybe in Milwaukee, and the Mets are playing the Phillies at home. And so there's 15 on one side. Catholic schools were much bigger back then. And 15 on the Mets side. And they needed someone to break it. And I'm just not even paying any attention at all. I'm just excited we don't have class for the last hour of the day, back when the games all started, too. And so they say, come on, Matt, which team is it? And I looked over, and I'm like, what are you even talking about? I knew that they were teams because, you know, I wasn't that dense, but I didn't know anything more than that. And so they asked me, and I'm looking over the guys who are Yankees fans. They're like, come on, vote the Yankees already. And the other guy's like, come on, vote the Mets. And I, like, looked over, and I noticed most of my friends were Mets fans, so I just said, I'll go with the Mets. And frosted the Yankees fans, and the Mets ended up winning that day, and I was pretty much hooked right from there. And it's something as, you know, random as that. You know, if it had been lived anywhere else, I could have chosen another team or something like that. But what the heck?
It seems like it happens like that with Mets fans.
It does. A lot of people come to it by you know, either from Brooklyn Dodger to Mets to there, and mine was just kind of like thrust right in there. And it worked out very nicely.
Now, now let's go to this. I know you've done a lot with the Mets, and we can get into some of that. But this book, your new book in particular, how did this project come about?
Well, I've been fortunate in a lot of these projects where one kind of begat another, and they called me. I have a website, MettSilverman.com, M-E-T, they contacted me and said, we're looking to do this. They had done a book on this with the Giants, and they'd done several NFL teams, and they were good books. They weren't great, but you know, NFL is a lot different than baseball. And the Twins had just done a book because this MVP Books is based in Minneapolis. Oh. So they had a couple writers from the Star Tribune out there, and they had access to all the photographs and everything like that. And it was a really well done book, and they sent me that. And so my focus completely changed. It's like I am not going to rest if the Twins have a better book than the Mets do. So and I've done a few of these books, and you hand them in, and then you kind of just hope that they do a good job. And they handed it in and did a better job than I could have imagined. I didn't realize they had the little poll thing until March when I got the books. I mean, they hadn't even told me. They told me that. It was remarkable because I'm looking at it online, and they had the secondary one that had the more contemporary players. And I'm like, how do you have a book about the first 50 Mets years and don't have Tom Seaver on the cover? And then when I got the book, I opened it up. I'm like, oh, you got them all on there. And there's actually even one of those gold leaf versions like the Danbury Mint or somebody makes. Right. That they did of this book that doesn't have that pull thing that they just sent me the other day that is very fancy and leather and all that. So that was kind of interesting too. I've never had a book that got the leather treatment unless, thrown against a mitt or something like that.
Well, they did. They took your work and they really did a beautiful job with it. And the book takes us really right through the entire history of the franchise, and right through the back with the all-time records of the franchise. And interspersed with that, you have the Mets' top 50. And let's talk about that a little bit. How did you come up with the top 50 players in Mets history?
Well, the first 40 were pretty easy. And that was another surprise. They actually made those baseball cards out of them. I was stunned that they had put those together. And so the first 40 were pretty easy. And then the last 10, there was a lot of tweaking, and I even asked some friends who are big bloggers and know an awful lot about the team about who they thought was number 48, essentially the number 45 to 50. And I was surprised that they went with a more statistical approach, and I was like, I didn't want to have a book where you see Armando Benitez's picture in there and you put it down because you were so annoyed about the whole thing. So we left him out, and we put Al Weiss in. But ironically, I'm working on a book right now for next year where I actually ranked them 1 to 50. And even some of the guys that are in there, I kind of phased out because of circumstances or because, over the course of a year, I'm like, this guy kind of does, like Dave Magadan, I'm like, I didn't realize his numbers were quite as good as they were. And some guys like that snuck in, but mostly it's the same. But ranking them was a lot harder. But coming up with the 40 the 50 was a lot of fun. And picking, there's some guys who were really close, and the Steve Hendersons and people like that. And then there was guys that I grew up with, like John Stearns and Lee Mazzilli and those guys in the 70s. I had to get them in there. Craig Swan pitched the first game I ever went to, And Dave Kingman, they put him on the cover, shows that the guy who's the publisher actually grew up in here about the same time, and he's the one that said put Kingman on the cover. But I know how many Mets fans from even the guy who just bought a piece of the team, supposedly he's still under review. He was a big Dave Kingman fan.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's funny because certain Mets, it's not necessarily a statistical thing, but certain ballplayers just hit Mets fans a certain way. Kingman is one of those guys. I mean, I can speak for myself. I remember when he was, that one year when he was going crazy with the home runs, and then he hurt himself. I was at summer camp, and my friends made me a black armband, and I had to wear it around for the rest of the summer. I was so depressed. And it's just one of those things.
They haven't had many guys who can hit, No. So even though he couldn't hit either, he could hit the ball far.
Occasionally.
Yes.
Yeah. He couldn't feel.
He could not feel. He heard himself fielding, which was the ironic part of all.
Absolutely.
He just, kind of jogged after like he did everything else. He probably would have hit 50, 60 home runs or something.
Yeah, one of the first lessons in fielding is there's no need to try to stand on your head to catch a fly ball. Mm-hmm. He just never got that. So who, if you have a favorite Met, who would your favorite Met be?
Like on the current team or
no,
all time?
All
or,
time.
I would probably say Tom Seaver just because he's Tom Seaver. But as far as guy, and I was lucky enough to work with him later on, but I got to work with Keith Hernandez on a book. And when I was in my 20s and going to college and the Mets finally got good after, stinking all through grade school and high school for the most part, that was when they got him, even though they were still last place. And I was like, wow, that's the Mets got Keith Hernandez. How did the Mets get Keith Hernandez? They gave him Neil Allen. I kept expecting Rick Ownby to become, the next Bob Gibson or something, and that it just didn't happen.
Absolutely. What about from the current team? Do you have a favorite Met?
It's just the kind of question I get asked at a lot of these school things, and I usually don't even think about it, but I would have to say 5 years ago I gave the same answer that I would probably give now, is Jose Reyes. Because I do think he's probably the most irreplaceable player on the team. And when he is not on the field, the Mets just aren't a very good team. And when he is on the field, they're that much better. I mean, it's not like they're a great team right now anyway, but when he's not on the field, there's a whole dynamic missing. You feel like the other team's like, whew, we don't have to worry about that leadoff spot.
Well, you may have to have a new favorite by next year. We'll see how that goes. Do you have a prediction on that?
We talked about it before, and I go either way. It doesn't seem like the current climate will allow him to be signed. I think a friend of mine is a big Red Sox fan. I said, thank you for the Carl Crawford. Thanks for Jason Bay, and thanks for the Carl Crawford contract that will almost assure that Jose Reyes doesn't stay here unless he has a change of heart at the last minute or decides he really wants to turn it around here. Because I think they can turn it around at some point, but... it's very difficult right now with the Phillies, but they are getting older, and the Braves, you don't know what their fiscal responsibilities are going to be either, These guys get older, you never can tell if they're going to stay or they're going to go, or they have other people to replace them. It happened to the Mets quick enough where they went from contenders every year to, contending until the 4th of July and then kind of playing up the string.
Exactly. And I don't know if you've been asked this question before or not, but I'll throw this out to you. Maybe this comes from with age. As I get older, I enjoy listening to managers sometimes more than listening to ball players. Do you have a favorite manager in Mets history?
Well, it's an interesting one because when I picked these, actually with the top 50, there wasn't really a chance to do that. But I did pick, I think I did profiles of three different managers, and it was Davey Johnson, Bobby Valentine, and Gil Hodges. And Bobby Valentine, lived through the whole Bobby V era, and I still think he did more with... I still think if he was managing the team right now, the team would be like two games out of first place, because that's his kind of team with all these cast-offs and this guy and that guy that nobody wants. But and Davey Johnson was obviously great, and he also had the best team, consistent team the Mets have ever had to work with. But I did a book on the 69 Mets a few years ago, and after working on it for over a year and a half, looking at every possible aspect, I still do not understand how that team won the World Series. It's one of the most amazing managing jobs ever, and even in a time when there was no offense at all, the Mets had even less offense, and that they were able to overtake the Cubs. I mean, that seemed like the hardest part. After that, they were almost on cruise control. And had three complete games in that series, and just amazing as they like to say. I think if Gil Hodges had lived, I think the 70s. I don't even think M. Donald Grant would have had the nerve to pull off half the stuff that he did there.
And
in the alternate universe I like to live in, Gil Hodges moves up to general manager. They boot out M. Donald Grant, and Whitey Herzog is named the manager. Because he helped put together the 69 team as well.
Yeah. That's a good alternate universe.
That is a good one. Yeah. Might as well. Might as well go for it. I was only Mets four at the time.
Absolutely. Did somebody have a question? No? Okay. And when you start to do a book, like your other Met books, obviously you're quite knowledgeable with the Mets. But when you start to have to tackle 50 years with a book like this, was this by far the most daunting book you've had to do yet, or how did you enjoy this? Let me put it that way, to compare it to your other Mets books.
I did, and I will thank them in advance. Well, I will thank them for being very patient, because I said, okay, I'm going to look, because like I said, I was just I wasn't even born when the Mets came into being, and they were just moved to Shea Stadium a year before when I was born, and have no memory of 69 or anything like that. So I wanted to look back at everything I could from before I was born and kind of throw out a lot of the stuff, because after working on a lot of the stuff, you kind of feel like you know it. I wanted to go back and check a lot of it. Certainly the stuff that predated the Mets existing, and read a lot about the Dodgers and the Giants moving and Bill Shea, and that's probably why he was the first line in there, because I really got to know him better and all the stuff he was doing. And, you know, he was either really sincere about bringing in the Continental League or was one of the great poker faces of all time, because the National League continued believing that he was going to bring a third league in despite all the logistical problems they had, because the National League did not want to expand. They were like, we can do fine without New York. And at the same time, the NFL was doing the same thing and all the other leagues. And within 10 years, most of the leagues had expanded, or there's been a rival league, and they'd eventually consolidated leagues. And so the Continental League was kind of the precursor to those. And they just threw together this whole league, and they hired Branch Rickey, who really, even though he was in his mid-70s then, back when nobody did, you know, anything like that at that age, right, advanced age, you know, because most people still smoked and drank and everything like that, so people didn't live as long, and they just kind of wrote you off like they did Casey Stengel when the Yankees fired him after he'd won 10 World Series, 10 pennants in 12 years, you know. And they had them quaking in their boots with Branch Rickey there, and eventually, I think it was the Braves owner capitulated. He was the head of some committee, and he's like, we've got to do this. And then the American League jumped the boat, and one thing that I did know, but I tried to publicize here in this book, is that in 61, the American League actually played 162 games, and the National League still played 154 games, because they had jumped the gun with expansion, which, when I saw that, I'm like, really? I was like, wow, that's something even Bud Selig wouldn't have tried. And it was very, very odd, and they really just slammed those two teams together. But as a result of that, the Mets, they had a full year knowing the Mets were going to come in, and the owners said, we're not going to get fleeced like those other owners in the American League were, because they had no time to set their lineup, and they finagled everybody who was any good out, so they would have to be in the minors, or they were away from an expansion draft. So the Mets ended up, and the Astros, the Colt 45s, who were the other team that came in, ended up with a dreck of the National League, actually in this Maple Street Press annual. Look back at it and saw all the players that Mets and Astros could have had and bypassed, like Dick Allen and Vic Davalio and even Robin Roberts, who had some good years left, and picked just like, you just look at him and you're like, you really thought that he was, you know, that Gus Bell had something left, you know. It's amazing what they came up with, but they got a team out of it, and I think the Mets drama just it started right there, where they kind of built up and gave you no expectations that were going to be good this year, next year, the year after, and then boom, they win the World Series.
Yeah, the track of the National League. I think I love that. That should be the name of your next book. it's funny though, because I think what you said is exactly right, but the Met fans seem to. It's interesting through Mets history. On one hand, Mets fans took to those teams very well with no expectations. And I think where ownership in recent years, this is just my opinion, where in recent years where they made some mistakes is they've done some, I mean, we don't have to sit there and recount all their crazy moves and trades and things that have not worked out. We don't have enough time for that. But I think they've had this attitude that if we don't get these guys and try to put something together, the fans are not going to be patient and want to see young guys come up and come along. And I think that's completely wrong. I think Met fans would take, and to some degree they have taken, to some of these young guys now that the team has kind of been forced into bringing up. And maybe that goes back through Mets history. I'm not sure. But I think maybe the ownership is miscalculated a little bit with that.
I think they have, too. I mean, attendance will take a hit. Attendance is taking a hit. But, you know, when they built the team up in the 80s, the year before 84, when they turned it around, they had the worst attendance in the National League, and that was after they brought back Seaver. And you just have to bite the bullet sometimes. I mean, if they trade Wright and Reyes, they're essentially doing that. And it's the kind of thing that they should have done several different times. And after Steve Phillips left, there was no reason they shouldn't have done it there. And I think that's what sort of changed the organization, is when they traded Scott Kazmir. They're ballyhooing these guys. These are your young kids. Have patience. Are going to be there. And then they trade him for Victor Zambrano, and they trade, you know, a bunch of other young players for Chris Benson. It's like, what? You know, it's like a third and a fourth starter. It's like, you know, when they really were dreaming that they had any chance on there. Right. And I think that was one of the big turning points in the franchise was that. And if they had been able to do more in the years after that, if they'd won another division title or two or gotten to the World Series somehow, I think you'd look back at it differently. But they tried to do too many quick fixes things. And the only time they've ever really picked good free agents was Pedro Martinez and Carlos Beltran in 2005, and they only got one good year out of Pedro. I mean, Pedro's not in the top 50, and for a new top 50, I took out Johan Santana because it's like these guys had one really good year.
Right.
And that was that.
Yeah.
But Beltran has been very good, and even he's gotten nothing but grief from fans, and he's missed a full year in, essentially over two seasons.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, since Frank Cashin, they really have not had a general manager who really has had a consistent plan on. I mean, Frank Cashin did some. When you go back and look at what he pulled together, it's really like what you said about Hernandez, how they get this guy for that, and you know, Gary Carter, and everything that he pulled together. I mean, it was just a tremendous team. And, you know, who knew that Gooden and Strawberry were going to self-destruct? I mean, if they did not, who knows what kind of run they would have had. But they haven't had a general manager really since that time. It's a long time already for a Mets.
It is, and there's a scary part of the story is that since Frank Cashin, since Davey Johnson and I guess Joe, go all the way back to Joe McDonald, they've never had a manager or a general manager that's actually been hired for that job again. That says something about the choices that they made. I mean, Frank Cashin essentially retired.
Right.
And even Davey Johnson, it took a few years to get in there, but I think that was beyond all that. But even Bobby Valentine, probably should have broken that streak. But it is a little disturbing at the choices that they made in regards to that. But I think Sandy Alderson has a good enough track record, and although I don't know what he's thinking all the time either. When I read those articles a few weeks ago in the New Yorker, and the one in Sports Illustrated just kind of made you feel sad for him. The one in the New Yorker made you want to strangle Fred Wilpon, and with his comments he made. If it was me, I'd have started sending discreetly sending out a resume after the day after that came out, because I don't know how you would want to deal with that kind of just essential incompetence that you're shooting yourself in the foot with that.
Yeah, it's interesting what...
And when, how... I'm not going to say it about the PR people, but how they let those comments get out without having somebody pull him aside after he made the first comment is unknown.
Right.
Remember, there were that many people in the Fernandez-Astros game, and I went the next night, which was really frustrating, and they won 9-1. It's like, if this guy had come that night, they probably would have said glowing things about everybody, but they went to a game where they kind of blew it, and they had guys doubled off and this and that and the other thing. It's all about timing.
It is all about timing. And speaking of going to a game, through the book, through your research, and there's through personal experience, what are your feelings of Shea versus City Field?
Well, I mean, I grew up going to games at Shea, and I'll always feel differently about that than City Field. I mean, City Field to me is a very nice park. It's a lot like a lot of other ballparks I've been to. And Shea, I went to a lot of those big concrete donut ones, and none of them were ever, had any of the personality that Shea did. I never got to Busch Stadium. That's the only one I might say I think might have been similar, but because the Cards did have a lot of positive things happen to them there as well. But, it always was very unique to me, and City Field is a really nice place to see a game and all that. But I just hope they don't mess around with it, because I still think that when they get good, they will have a serious home field advantage. And they'll have teams. There's already the Phillies, and other teams hate coming in there. And I would not want to take that away as much as, the teams can't hit home runs anyway.
Right.
So what do you? We have a thing in the Maple Street Press Mets guy that kind of analyzes the whole thing, looks at other teams that move the fences in. And a lot of times when you move the fences in, it doesn't even really change the results. Sometimes it's something random that you do that, changes the whole thing. And, I when I think of a big ballpark, I think of the St. Louis Cardinals, who even in the year of the home run in 87 didn't even crack 100 home runs and won the division and won the pennant because they had a team that was built for that ballpark.
Absolutely.
It's like if you don't move the fences in, move your team,
Well, I could, if I'm wrong, you can correct me, but I believe that as of the date of this podcast, the Mets are last in the National League in home runs and first in runs scored. I believe. I could be wrong.
They did have an awful lot of runs scored for a team that's as mediocre as they are.
And that's with Wright and other guys,
yes.
Ike Davis out of the lineup.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And they had, I think they were ahead of everyone in the division except for the Phillies, and the Phillies were not as far ahead of them as you would think.
Right.
Well, at least the last time I looked.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And a question on the, in your beginning chapter, and it kind of takes us through the book, which is really, besides the narrative and what we were talking about before, the top 50 baseball cards featuring each of these guys, part of the subtitle of the book is The Complete Illustrated History, and that's exactly what this is. It takes you through from 1962 on, with tons of beautiful artifacts. Did you have to find that, or did the publisher find that? I mean, there's some really unique things in here.
It was a group effort. I do a lot of research, photo research every year for the Mets annual, and so I actually knew what a lot of the most available photos were. And I looked into a bunch of other archives, and I sent them a list. Before I even started writing the book, I spent probably 2 weeks just going through all those photo archives and seeing ones that might fit what I was trying to do. And they actually found pictures I didn't even know existed. And but a lot of the ephemera in there is either mine, such as yearbooks and the pennants and things like that, or either stuff that I have that I've had for since I was a kid, or stuff that the publisher had from when he was a kid, or they somehow got.
When you said that, I'm flipping through the book, when you said photos that you've never seen, there's one of Mr. Met riding a bike through, looks like, I don't know where this is, in Manhattan or somewhere, but this is a tremendous photograph. There's just some really unique things that are interspersed throughout the book. It's really beautifully done. And speaking of Mr. Met, did he make your list of top 50 Mets?
He did not. There was some weird stuff. That was one of the things that we had a little disruption between the publisher and myself on which Mr. Met to get in there. Because the one picture he has of Mr. Met is kind of this hybrid between the Wilpons essentially saying, that's lowbrow or whatever happened to Mr. Met. He was not there for a long time. And they brought out this kind of new, they had this thing called the Nickelodeon theme park. And they had this gigantic head, Mr. Met with an even bigger head. And he ended up in the book as opposed to the traditional one, although they have a very nice Mr. Met bobblehead that's on the first page of the whole thing.
Yeah, it's beautiful, which is how the book begins, basically. And somebody told me this. I don't know if you found this in your research or not, but they claim that Mr. Met was based upon the Cincinnati Redleg or whatever the name is.
That is interesting.
And we have this old vintage-style T-shirt here that has that logo on it. And to be honest, after you look at it, it does kind of look like the Mets did take this off.
Well, it's ironic because that you mentioned that, because just today I saw something on the UniWatch blog that tracks all this kind of uniform stuff. And the Tigers have essentially the same thing as a T-shirt that I have of Mr. Met running, except it says Tigers. And I know which guy you're talking about. They had the red leg guy, and he's got kind of that handlebar,
right, with a big
1870s,
right.
Mustache and the hat and everything like that.
Right.
And I think that dates back to like the 40s or 50s.
Right.
And they just kind of appropriated it. Although the current version that they have, and even the, you know, they had it with paper mache originally, is a little different. But the Reds, I think, had given up on that kind of a thing, but it is a good point that he may well be an amalgam of that and maybe some other obscure mascot that came and went that we don't even know about.
Yeah, well, other than Tom Seaver, he's probably my favorite Met of all time. We have a question from one of our Met fans.
With a Mr. Met shirt on.
Yes.
What happened to the sign man? Why was he given the boot?
The players didn't like him. It seems that, you know, he gave him essentially was giving him a hard time. And I know Ed Cranepool didn't like him. And I think it was the early 80s that they, maybe it had to do with the change of ownership, but I think he tried to come back a couple of times and they either, it was a little bit, his heart wasn't as much into it, and the new ownership didn't quite get what he was doing. Which would not be the first time that something like that has occurred. And he just said, you know, to heck with it. And, went back to watching the games at home and all that, which is a shame because I always thought that he was at every game, but reading up on him, he mostly went on Tuesdays and Fridays. So you didn't necessarily see him all the time.
You felt like you did.
But you felt like you did.
Yeah.
You know, and if you had seats that were near you and the sign man was there, the sign man's here.
He was fantastic.
And he was an inspiration. Was there, I think, from the mid 60s to about 1980 or so, maybe the early 80s, was his heyday as there. And he died just before Shea closed.
Oh wow. Yeah.
No, I got David Johnson.
More important manager to the Mets than Casey Stengel and Yogi Berra were through there?
Well, I always thought of, I'm trying to go ahead as number four. I usually put Yogi Berra number four. I usually kind of put Casey, I actually have a profile of Casey in here, but I kind of remove him from there because he's got one of the worst winning percentages of all time, and it's really hard to judge him compared to everybody else, but I do think it was one of the best hires the Mets made in their first 7 or 8 years, because he completely took a lot of the pressure off and put the focus on himself and allowed them to develop the team. And you know, I thought in the Mets 100 things to know and do before you die, he was in the top 20. So I do have a profile of him, but he's more along the lines of a mover and shaker as opposed to, you know, strategist or, you know, anybody they expected to win. And they actually talked about firing him at one point, or at least not bringing him back. And then the Mets said, you know, sort of came to their senses and said, well, what difference is it going to make? It's, you know, it'll make a big difference with the fans, but will the team really be that much better? And then he broke his hip the next year anyway. And they could have hired Yogi Berra a couple of different times, but they hired Wes Westrum and then they hired Gil Hodges, and they brought Yogi Berra in, who, didn't really stay that long, but was you know, won, they've only won four pennants, and he won. I have four different managers won pennants with them. So, you know, that the Casey Stengel definitely gets his due, and he really helped get the team off on the right foot, because he could tell right from the get go that this is going to be just an incredibly bad team. You know.
Yeah, Casey was perfect at that period. I mean, they were all kids. They were all unknown quantities in a couple of weeks back. But Casey was this, he was right out of Central Casting. I mean, he did what he did in his career, and he established himself good and bad. The Yankees thought he was done. But he, like you said, your analogy is perfect. He took the heat off the kids, let them establish and gel, and he also gave the ability for the young fans to just almost relate that he was the team's elder, just like their parents or grandparents were in their own lives. And it was that the fan base of young kids back in the early 60s, they just gravitated to that. It was just, he was just so likable. Didn't even matter. Wins or losses.
No, and the Mets actually did accrue a fair bit of Yankees fans who just, it was like that's their dad's team, and it was, the Mets were excited. Even though they were losing, and they outdrew the Yankees a lot.
I mean, I don't want to be kicked out of here. I'm really enjoying the conversation, but I'm a Yankee fan, and I'm here for some Mets fans. But, I mean, they were, my first game at Shea Stadium in 1965, I went with a class trip, and they used to fill the stands with classes and school trips. I had so much fun. The team was horrible. They played in Houston. They botched a pop-up in the infield, and it was just, it was fun to watch. But the thing I'll never forget is the enthusiasm of the fans. The fans just love them. Absolutely love them. Without question.
And you had something else?
Yeah, to a degree, wasn't that what George Bamberger did when he came in as manager, being an established manager, having a very young team? And to some degree, Joe Frazier?
Well, Joe Frazier, they had... I'm not really sure why they chose Joe Frazier after... Even all these years later, I'm still kind of figuring what the heck they were thinking about with that particular... Because they fired Yogi, they brought in Roy McMillan, and they were like, there's no way this guy can manage the team. And they needed to bring in someone else, and he was their top AAA guy. But that team, that was a veteran team that was... They weren't supposed to win because they really still couldn't hit, even though they had Kingman and all that. They needed another bat. And they did have some young players, but they were still, you know, they had Matalak and Kuzman and Seaver and Kingman, and, you know, they had a lot of Bono, John Milner, and Felix Mian, and they had some guys who could really play. And why he was there, I still don't know. And he had one year where that they kind of won in spite of him. They still weren't anywhere close to the Phillies, ran away with it from the beginning. And George Bamberger actually had the team in contention, but he pretty much took the job because as a favorite of Frank Cashin. And I always think of him as, you know, one of the, you know, he quit on the team the next year, which was in some ways a godsend. And they were supposed to be developing ball players. I just saw that Mets highlight video from 1982 they have on SNY, and that was kind of the theme they were going with, but I couldn't figure out if there's a theme they were going with because they were in first, you know, second or third place in July, or they lost like 17 games in a row and like 40 out of 45 near the end of the season. That really, you know, they kind of retroactively glossed it over, but they certainly, you know, made the right decision in bringing in another old Frank Cashin buddy in Davey Johnson, who they were lucky to keep in the system because they almost lost him because of like a slight disagreement he had with one of the other guys in there. He was actually going to go to the Cardinals, and I think it was Lou Gorman talked him into staying, and that was a good move.
Yeah, that was very positive.
Yeah, I mean, I think every team has this with managers, but maybe because I'm a Mets fan, I see it that way. But there's such a fascinating managerial history with this franchise that it really, you just touched on a lot of these points. And one thing I think that we should not lose sight of dealing with a manager is it still comes down, you either have the horses or you don't. And when you, if you want to just look at you could just say two of the worst managers in Mets history by their record. Not the two worst, but two of the worst would be Casey Stengel and Joe Torre.
Yep.
You could also say among two of the greatest managers in Yankee history. So either you have the horses or you don't in a lot of these cases. Other cases, even with the horses, it may be a little tough. But without the horses, you can't win. And I agree with what you said, that Casey was the perfect guy at that time. I think the Mets history would have been very different of your first chapter and the first chapter of Mets history if Joe Smith was the manager of the Mets instead of a guy, Casey Stengel, whoever it was.
Yes, like I'm trying to think who the Astro first Houston Colt 45 manager is. And
Barry Pratt.
There you go. Very good. I was going to say I don't know, but he does. So that's why we've got the knowledgeable audience. But, it's like that's not that's as obscure as Wes Westrum or Roy McMillan or something like that for the most part, And you're right, Torre and Casey Stengel, I think, have the two worst records and will probably both end up in the Hall of Fame as managers.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Did anyone else have a question from our bleachers and Shea?
I have a question. When you first became a Mets fan, your story about being in school, what was your first game? How soon after that was your first game, and what was that like?
Well, it is kind of weird because we went on a camp trip to Shea Stadium like the previous year, and I was paying so little attention. I don't even know how I ended up on the trip, and I don't even remember if it was the Mets or the Yankees. And I've thought about it and all, but it's like we're sitting in one of those horrible seats in the mezzanine where you can barely even see the field, much less who's playing. I'm assuming it was the Yankees because it was the 74, and everybody at this camp and near Pelham was a Yankees fan, so we probably were seeing the Yankees. But my dad took me to Old Timers Day for the Yankees at Shea in 1975, and I was so naive that I'm like, they're both in the town. Why should I be, root for one or the other? And for about a month, I tried it, and it was just like, this can't be done. This is not going to work. And I still like those Yankees announcers, Frank Messer and Bill White and Phil Rizzuto. I didn't like Phil Rizzuto so much, but I did really like Bill White and Frank Messer. And I used to watch their games a lot, even after I stopped liking them. And then my first Mets game was at the end of August, then my dad took me on a Saturday afternoon, and they had their B lineup in because they'd had the Friday twi-night doubleheader that is not even a kid today would not even they might understand a doubleheader, but the twi-night twin bill on a Friday that didn't require everyone 2,000 people coming at 1 o'clock and 30,000 people coming at 7 o'clock, yeah. Is just a whole different thing. So I got Jesus Alou and Gene Kleins and some other guys, and Craig Swan was on the mound when he was still kind of proving himself. I think Dave Kingman played though. Rusty Staub at the first home run, because they have since looked that game up.
Well, he's definitely in your top 50.
Le Grand Orange, yes,
yeah.
And he was one of actually. It was so. There was a lot of stuff that I created for this book that didn't even get in because of space. And I had this long interview about the mid '70s with Rusty Staub that I used two quotes out of. And I talked to him before a game last year for about an hour.
Do you have any future Mets books in the works yet? Or
there's this one called Best Mets. It's a bunch of different lists on the top 50 things, the top 50 years, the first 50 years of Mets history with the top this and top that. And I, normally wouldn't be brazen enough to do this, but it's the sixth book. And so I was taking a lot of it's all new material pretty much, but sort of ranking some of them from a historical point of view. And, a lot more stuff like that, the best games and looking back on a lot of different stuff and the best players and, using the top 50 that you would pick if you used the wins above replacement or some other statistical thing and then took the top 50 from there, and even that, not all those guys made it.
Well, that sounds like a fun project to work on.
Yes, I'm still finishing it up right now. And actually, a couple of the pieces, I did something on all the Sign Man and Jerry Seinfeld and a lot of those guys that we weren't able to get in the book, in this book, that I'm going to use in there, tweak them and put them in there.
Well, we look forward to reading that one. And to those who are here tonight in the clubhouse, we'll be fortunate enough to be able to purchase your book. To those listening to the podcast, if you're a Mets fan or you know a Mets fan, this is really a beautiful book. Once again, it's called New York Mets, 50 Amazing Seasons, The Complete Illustrated History by Matthew Silverman, published by MVP Books. And Matt, we really appreciate that you've come tonight, and it's been a pleasure, and let's go Mets.
Well, thanks very much for having me. It was a pleasure being in the clubhouse.
Thank you.